Hello, and welcome to Show 5 of the Scottish Football Marketing Podcast from the Scottish FA. Each show, we discuss a topic with an expert in the field that with the sole aim of helping clubs at all levels in Scotland with their marketing efforts. We recorded this podcast at the start of August, and we've been really excited about getting this one out. We had Mark Bradley from the Fan Experience Company on to chat what clubs in Scotland can do to improve their fan experience. Mark really is a fascinating guy to listen to. He has done some work in Scotland before, which he talks about in this show. He also talks about all the various touch points a club should consider and provides plenty of ideas, even if your club's on next to no budget. As always, you can get in touch with Chris Sampson and I, Michael Bockel, via Twitter or LinkedIn. Your feedback has been very much appreciated. You can also follow Mark, which I highly recommend, on Twitter, and he's at Fan Experience Co. Enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the Scottish FA's Scottish Football Marketing Podcast. I'm Chris Sampson from Sports Marketing Scotland, and I'm joined as ever by my talented co-host, Scottish FA Digital Manager Michael Bockel.
Thanks very much. This is a podcast I think we've both been looking forward to.
Yep.
Since we put this idea together, really around the podcast. This week, going to be looking at fan experience. I think a big opportunity to do more across the board in Scotland. We've talked about it personally before. I know you flagged out a few examples across your channels as well about clubs that have been doing some good stuff in this area.
Yep.
Call out a couple early doors. Motherwell recently, I think Alan Barrows, especially on Twitter, is quite prominent and is calling out a lot of sort of good examples of stuff that they have been doing, even from simple things like just painting certain things within the stadium just to try and sort of bring the whole vibe at Fir Park up. Celtic, obviously, doing a lot of good stuff there at the moment in time. From what they've done with Celtic Way to the in-stadium, and obviously they've spent a fair bit of money on the lights, which I'm fairly looking forward to seeing them in action. St Mirren as well, they do a lot. I know they do a lot around kids and making sure that there's a lot of activities from that side of things, and I think they've been quite big on it from the start. And our guest this week is Mark Bradley from the Fan Experience Company, and I know he had done some work in Scotland before. We'll get him to talk about that, and St Mirren have been doing a lot of work in this area for a long time. I don't know, from your side of things, obviously I've probably stolen some of the main ones there, but anything from your side that you've seen?
I think a lot of the times it's just the little things that jump out at me. I mean, a couple of weeks back we touched on Dundee's examples, just keeping in touch with a loyal fan who was about to go abroad and a friendly got cancelled. It's just little things like that that go a huge way to delight Scottish football fans from their clubs. And again, we'll touch on this when we're talking to Mark, but a lot of the times it feels like just simple things to me. And I think we're looking forward to more getting done across this space, across the season and in the future.
Yeah, hopefully this is a good succession as well from our first podcast. And obviously, if you've not listened to that one yet, recommend you go and listen. It was all around research and insights. And I think a big thing about improving fan experience and engaging with fans is actually listening to fans. And we'll talk to Mark more about that and push him on how clubs can do a bit more in this space, and hopefully that there's a few things there that clubs at all levels can pick up.
Definitely.
And on that note, let's bring in Mark Bradley from the Fan Experience Company to take us through his experience of working with a number of different clubs.
Mark, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
We wanted to quickly touch on your background just to start off with and what the Fan Experience Company does. So if you could kick us off there, that'd be great.
It's actually quite a difficult question because there isn't really a career around what I did. My background was in customer service. So go back 15, 20 years, I was a consultant working with organizations to improve levels of customer engagement. And around that time, I did some small bits of work for the Premier League, trying to help clubs understand that if they wanted government to look at them more positively, you know, see them as a more positive organisations, then they should get a little closer to their customers. You know, but back then, as is still the case now, calling football supporters customers is likely to get you a lot of abuse on social media. So my background really was in all industries, helping all industries become much more customer focused. And it was by a weird kind of quirk of fate that I ended up working in football. But having said that, you know, I'm a lifelong Sunderland fan. I'm actually only 26. I look like this because I'm a lifelong Sunderland fan. So, you know, that's that. Those two worlds connected in around 2005 when my wife and I started the business. And you don't want me to talk for hours on this, but I think there was two ideas in the back of my mind. One was that if you've got an industry or a business even, or a company that seems to be struggling to deal with change, one of the ways that you can create a bit of a catalyst is to show them what it's like to be one of their customers. Now, obviously, TripAdvisor has become a multi-million pound business by doing just that. You know, it's not as if we didn't have customer surveys or customer feedback or mystery shopping before TripAdvisor came along, but the fact that it did and it made it so easy for people to talk about their experiences has had a dramatic effect, particularly in the hospitality industry. So what we were thinking of was, I'd written a couple of books about what it was like to be a British customer, a kind of customer service travelogue, if you like, a couple of them. One was called Inconvenience Stores, great title, and the other one, Retails of the Unexpected. So this is going back 16, 17 years. But the idea was rather than write a theoretical book about why British service is terrible, why not to write it as if it's a kind of a travelogue through one family's eyes over 12 months, what their experiences are like. So I did that and then looked at different industries and thought, yeah, that's possibly a way in. So I can use my experience of helping businesses grow through better customer service. But, you know, I was looking for a way to get in. And I thought this idea of showing them what it could be like to be a customer would do it. However, what took me by surprise was the fact that the first organization to approach us was the English Football League. And they said, we like the idea of actually turning a mirror back on the organization. And we have a perception, perhaps, we're not sure, that maybe new families are turned off by the experience, that clubs are not doing enough to actually, you know, deliver something that will make it easier for, say, a dad that hasn't been to see his team because he's got kids, to be able to bring them back. You know, we're not talking about, you know, Waitrose shoppers suddenly being converted to football. You know, we're talking about families where one of the parents in the past had been a match attending fan, but life takes over, you've got kids, and it's very difficult to make a case study to your other half to take the kids back if all you're reading in the media is that football's full of you know, antisocial behavior and foul and abusive language. So we started doing that with the Football League. It was me, my other half Anna, and my two kids, who would have been about 10 and 7 at the time. And we attended 30 consecutive Football League matches, home and away, over the 2006-2007 season. I always joke that at the end of which, my wife was communicating with me through a firm of solicitors, you know, having dragged her around every League One, Two and Championship club.
Must have seen some sights.
She certainly did. You know, some I can describe now, some would upset your audience. And, you know, and some shouldn't be, you know, repeated with children listening. But it was very interesting because it actually showed that with a little effort, not a huge amount of effort, with a little investment, you know, not a massive investment, and a kind of a different mindset, it would be possible to actually reach out to those people. I mean, I joke that, you know, back in 2004, 2005, we live in Bradford, so we're about 100 miles from the Stadium of Light. You know, so that's God's own, you know, football ground, currently on a tour of the divisions in England just to see what it's like. And I would have to make a case to Anna. I would have to say something like, okay, how do you fancy a weekend up in Newcastle with your mates? Have a few drinks, go and see a show. What are you going to do? Well, I'll look after the kids. You know, suspicion immediately. What are you going to do with them? Oh, I'll take them to the football. What? And you think, right, this is when it gets difficult. How do I make a case? So she'll say, will the stewards be friendly? No. Will there be anything for the kids to do before the game? No. Will there be anything for them to do if and when they get bored? Probably when, at Sunderland? No. Will the food be healthy and the type of thing kids would get on the high street? No. You know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Can you park at the stadium? No. You know, it just would go on and on and on. And of course, we'd then get the coup de grace when she says, and what about the antisocial behavior and all of the abusive language? And I would say, well, we won't stay at my parents. You know, we'll go straight to the ground. But, you know, kind of joking apart, that's a challenge that more than one person must have had. So that's how it started. So 2006, 2007, working with the Football League and then establishing the Family Excellence Scheme, which, believe it or not, has run for the 12 seasons since. We've just renewed again in the last couple of weeks to provide every one of the 72 Football League clubs with an experienced assessor visit at the start of the season, looking at everything, single touch point for the new family group. And then towards the end of the season, the moment of truth is when we send a genuine new family in there to see what the experience is like. And over the 10, 11 years that we've done it, there are 6 million more kids attending Football League games. So this is tier 2, 3 and 4. 37% increase in junior attendance. And Football League attendances are at their highest since 1959. You know, so that we had no idea. When I sat down with Darren Bernstein, who was at the Football League, who Greg Mailer will remember, Darren's back at the FA next, I think. He's back at the FA. It was his idea originally. That then led us to look at other supporter types. So we looked at the experience of disabled supporters. We looked at the experience of away supporters. That's something we've done for the last 3 or 4 years. We've looked at women going to the men's game. We've looked at non-league football. We've done just about everything. And we've even looked at it for Scottish fans, but for new families in Scotland. So, you know, we've picked up, there's a lot of things different according to the needs of different groups. I mean, that's the point of having different groups. They all have different needs. But equally, we've picked up a few, you know, bigger things as we've gone along. And in the last 2 or 3 years, we've kind of got out behind from our desks and out of the car and start to take some of these ideas into Europe. So we're now working in Denmark with the Superliga, with the Women's League there, in Estonia, trying to grow attendances there. And we are hoping to start working with the Eredivisie in the next couple of weeks, just waiting for the final kind of confirmation there. So it's been an interesting ride.
It sounds like it's been very varied. Can you touch on a little bit of the work you've done in Scotland?
Yeah, well, Greg got in touch. I was doing a little bit of work for Middlesbrough in around 2008. And we had a call from Greg saying that he'd be interested in having a chat. We went up there, met Greg, met Neil, talked about challenges for Scottish football. And for me, I think the biggest challenge is that it just has very kind of low self-esteem, or it had, you know. There's probably no more purer version of football, no more passionate fans in the world. You know, my son spent some time in Argentina. I said, what was the football like there? He said, you're almost as raw as Scotland. You know, and it's kind of and what we were trying to do again was to create a bit of a catalyst. It wasn't just a question of giving feedback to the clubs on what the family experience was like, but actually saying, look, that, you know, this should be a catalyst for thinking differently about some of your long-term challenges. And I remember the first club to really kind of stuck their necks up above the parapet was St Mirren. You know, they were in the process of moving from Love Street to the new ground. And, you know, it was strange that it was actually the smallest club in the SPL at the time that were the one that was actually, you know, it provided a catalyst for them to think, actually, this could be what makes us special. We're small. That makes us more accessible. That makes us easiest to get the players to give autographs to kids. You can feel part of the club. You don't feel remote or detached, and that was a bit of support for Brian Caldwell at the time, who's, I think he's now at Shrewsbury down in England. So that was interesting. I have to say it was difficult. We didn't get the immediate kind of buy-in from the clubs up there, but looking back, you know, it's probably mostly my fault. It maybe wasn't the best fan type to start with. Maybe, you know, a lapsed fan would have been a better one to start with. You know, somebody who'd stopped going, bring them back with their mates, look at the experience and use their feedback. You know, because I say it is kind of the home of the core fan Scottish football. It's got a lot to be proud of. I mean, you know, the highest per capita attendance of any European league. You know, I know there are empty spaces and a lot of club stands, but in terms of the level of passion there is nationally for the game up there. So I think maybe that's one thing I would have done differently if I look back. But we're talking, you know, to people all the time up there, and saw Neil quite recently. And, you know, you never know. There might be an opportunity soon coming up again to do something. And, you know, I think we'd probably do it differently.
There must be things that you recommended back 8, 9 years ago when you were up doing that set of things that are still relevant that probably clubs haven't implemented so far.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the easiest three, and myself and a couple of colleagues recently look back at, you know, when clubs get a really good report, you know, where they come up doing incredibly well. There are lots of different touch points, for want of a better word, that we look at. And the three that commonly are done best by the clubs that get that you know, generate the highest level of advocacy from the people coming along are the finding information bit. So that's first impressions. So that's the information available on the website. So is it, you know, is the information there for somebody, let's say, you know, returning to a game for the first time in 10 years, or for a family taking their kids? So something like a first-time fan or a new-to-the-club page. And it's not just getting things like directions and ticket purchase, but it's actually putting yourself in their shoes and thinking, right, they're going to be worrying about travel. They're probably going to wonder about what food's available. You know, and I love my Scotch pies. I mean, I have to, you know, the Arbroath steak and black pudding one is the best, you know, by some distance, closely followed probably by the Killy selection. But, you know, Arbroath are out there. You know, and just you know, not be shy of the fact that, oh, it's going to be a tatty burger and a few Scotch pies, but actually, here's what it is, how much it costs. You know, Durham Women, who were only founded 5 years ago and get average attendances of 500 now, they don't own the ground. You know, they hire a ground, they don't own the facility, but they do a lot of things on social media, like putting out a match day calculator saying that, you know, the cost of a pie, cost of a drink for your kids, parking's free, programs a pound, it's only £4 to come in, £10 for a family of four, your whole match day will cost no more than this. They put that out on social media. And it's different. It's unique. Nobody does that. And I think we've kind of made the assumption, north and south of the border, that it's football. You know, we built it. You come. We don't need to make an effort. So I think the first thing is having much more, if you like, diverse information that reflects your existing fan base and also the people you're trying to attract on your website. And obviously, by definition, pushing that out through social media. The second one, believe it or not, is travel. A lot of reasons people don't go is because they think it's going to be difficult to get there, that they can't park. And this, so that, and when clubs get it right, and often clubs getting it right could be something like, yeah, it is difficult to park here, but this bus will get you right outside. This, you know, this park and ride will get you very close. Or by getting here before an hour before kickoff, you know, you can be sure of a space on site. Oh, and by the way, as you're getting here early, don't miss the social club, don't miss the Scotch pie, don't miss the et cetera, et cetera. And the third one you touched on when we talked before we started the chat this evening about your last podcast on volunteers, and, you know, more widely than volunteers, but generally the people that work for the club, the more that they are connected and motivated and supported by the club, you know, they are the ones that deliver the magic moments. They're the ones that people come back and have a chat with. And, you know, in British football generally, I see very low levels of support. There's a kind of a high level of expectation from them, but they don't get celebrated. They don't get recognised. Very few clubs have an opportunity for fans to vote for a volunteer of the year or a volunteer for the month. And something like that is just made for social media, you know. And again, so those three things are relatively easy to do. Don't cost much in terms of, you know, well, don't cost anything really, other than the time that it takes someone to do it. So I think that's important. And I one last thing I would say as well with kids is kids want to kick a football. So any opportunity you give kids to kick a football, if it's dreek in the middle of November and the groundsman doesn't want them on the pitch, fair enough. But why not have one of those inflatable, you know, goals outside or an inflatable dartboard? And yet they cost a bit, but, you know, few clubs get together, or a league hires one, moves it around from ground to ground. You know, it's something extra.
Yeah, I'd say just on that kicking a football, that takes me back to being a kid. Grew up in Nairn, so Nairn County Station Park, and I always just remember kicking a ball behind the goal. But the game was going on, and okay, you watched a little bit of the game, but that's one of my earliest memories of going to the football, is just kicking a ball behind the goal.
Yeah, and that's it, because if you go, and this is where the bigger clubs suffer, because when I was a little lad going to Roker Park with my dad, you'd be stuck in a seat, you know, or it wouldn't be in a seat, I'd be standing in the paddocks at the side of the pitch, but you couldn't go anywhere. You know, you couldn't sort of wander off because your dad doesn't want to lose you. There's a lot of people there, mostly old men, you know, smoking and what have you. But the smaller the ground, the bigger the space. You know, says something like Central Park over in Cowdenbeath. Yeah. You know, you look at that, there's space everywhere, you know, and you can move around, and there's a little area before you come in where you can, you know, you can do things and move around. And I think sometimes, you know, clubs think because we don't have a modern stadium, an all-seater stadium, you know, people somehow are put off from coming to see us. But actually, some of those things those bits of space behind the goal, those areas that we've inherited, that weird thing at Dundee, you know, that little area, you know, those type of things are actually what make us unique. And we would in Lyngby, which is just been relegated from the Superliga in Denmark, they have a big circular space behind one of their goals, and they have a permanent fan zone in it, and most of it is kids' entertainment. So when they're live on Danish TV, and I think every game in the Superliga is carried live, all you can see when there's a corner is a bunch of kids having fun behind the goal, and it looks brilliant, you know. And imagine if you were a kid and you saw that, and you thought, that's brilliant, I don't have to sit in my seat, I can go and do something, you know, if it gets boring. And as you can tell by Lyngby's relegation, it did last season, you know?
Plenty of examples there for some clubs to take up. What would you say are some of the other most common pitfalls, aside from clubs maybe not using their a bit of common sense and using their stadium?
Yeah, some of these are more kind of strategic, and some of them are more specific. But for example, a friend of mine, Julian Jenkins, you may have heard the name. Julian was at Cardiff, did a lot of amazing things there with the family front. And he said he would find clubs where they would put on a special deal for families. I mean, we've done a lot of work with families, you know, it's not all we work with, but, and they'd say, right, okay, we're going to do four tickets for 20 quid. We're going to have a fun fair. We're going to make a real effort. We're going to pull all the stops out. And so a family comes down, takes advantage of the deal, has a fantastic time. The kids can't wait to come back. So what happens at the next home game? Well, the tickets are now 40 quid for a family of four, and there isn't a fun fair. It's kind of like, what organization thinks that's a good recruitment policy? You know, it's got to be something you can deliver week in, week out. And fundamentally, it's not going to be a fun fair. You know, it's going to be something, an opportunity, for example, for kids to use a hashtag to choose the halftime playlist for the music, you know, so them and their mates come. One of the best ones I ever saw was at a little club in the Northwest, Marine, who play at about the sixth, seventh level of English football, where they realized that kids were happy to come and take penalties at half time, you know, against the mascot. But actually what interests kids more than anything else is beating kids from other schools in their neighborhood. So they started having an inter-school penalty tournament. So, you know, if you've got seven games, you can have quarterfinals, semifinals, final. And those kids are coming back to see how their five do in the next round, you know, at half time. So they're probably not even coming for the senior game. They come in because it's an opportunity to be competitive against other schools on a pitch. And if the weather's bad, it might be off the pitch, you know. But those are the type of things that get kids to come back. You know, and I mean, eSports, no doubt you'll be doing a podcast just on eSports.
Definitely.
The potential to use eSports to get people to come and enjoy the offline experience is huge. You know, you'll get clubs now that one or two Xboxes that aren't executed well. One big kid will be hogging one machine, you know, for half an hour. Other kids don't have a go. Go to somewhere like Brøndby in Copenhagen with their... They've got that area set up like an eSports competition area, you know, so it's treated almost with a kind of a sacred sense of respect, where people come in, get their names down, play proper tournaments. In Norway now, they've recruited a guy through the FA who's a big, you know, a big YouTuber, a big gamer, a really famous guy that makes lots of money. And he will preside over tournaments at the national stadium before a Norwegian international team game, and they've not qualified for a major tournament for many years, but you've now got hundreds of kids are turning up, playing, and then staying for the game afterwards. More strategic, I think, is the fact that what we're actually trying to do here is drive sustainability. You know, this is not an end in itself. It's not get more kids into football. That's one solution to helping a club become more sustainable. What we're trying to do is to provide revenue for clubs, is to help them find ways of sustainably moving forward, whether that's losing fans at a slower rate than they were previously, well, that's improving sustainability, whether it's maintaining attendances against a difficult backdrop, perhaps, you know, Sunderland would be a good example, dropping two divisions in two seasons, or whether it's actually sustainably growing, so your attendances are growing without actually you performing well on the pitch. So I think there are four areas, and there are kind of four pillars that I've mentioned in previous discussions with people, that I think that clubs of any size, if they think about them and they understand the way that they interrelate, they actually provide a little bit of a roadmap, you know, for building a club. And the first one is the club's identity. And I mentioned our growth before. My son and I, in fact, it was 2 days after his 18th birthday, he's 23 later this year, we went up to see them play East Fife. And we turned up an hour and a half before kickoff, thinking that that's when the turnstiles would open, you know, because that's what they do down here. And having taken the train up from Edinburgh, of course, crossing both the big rivers, you know, seeing how beautiful it was, and the amazing skies and sunsets and everything in November. As a fella meets us outside, and, you know, I can't possibly do the Arbroath accent, but he greeted us, you know, explained that the turnstiles weren't opening. But he then knocked on one of these little panels, and like a guy says, hello, you know, come straight. And this guy was about to open the turnstile, but opened it early for us, for me and my son. And when we got inside, this little fella showed us round, told us to have the steak and black pudding pie. We'd have had no idea about that, but he told us and when to have it by because they sell out. He then took us up into the little social club. We met the program editor, who was from Bristol, who was a Bristol Rovers fan, looked like a pirate, had a big sort of Bristol Rovers quarter top on. It's a long story how he ended up there, but it's something to do with a woman from Arbroath.
We'll save that for another podcast.
Yes, exactly. And it kind of, and all we're thinking all the time, this is so unique. This is so special. This is so different. And yet when you extrapolate it across the whole of Scottish football at the time, how many clubs are really trading on what makes them different? Is it the bush at Brechin?
It's the hedge.
The hedge thing. And it's kind of, I didn't know about that till I went there, you know, and it's kind of, what I would have loved, you know, what I'm saying is that any growing organisation needs to be strong on brand. And the brand has got to be more than just 90 minutes of football if you want to get people to come and start attending. And so the first thing for me is identity. You know, what's your identity? What makes you different? And the question I ask all clubs is, what are you for? You know, why? Would the world miss you if you left? You know, what is it? It's because it's not the football, is it? It's, you know, it's not. If I say to Montrose, you know, why? What does Montrose exist for? Yeah, they'll say, well, we want to win things.
Well, they won the league. Won the league last season.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. That's why I switched from Brechin. See how it's that one. But you know that there's we can't control what happens on the pitch, and you know we can't control everything that happens off it, but we can certainly control a lot more of it. And I think a lot of clubs. I remember Anna saying to me when we did those 30 visits in 2006-07. At the end of which, I said, "Which one of those clubs would you want to take the kids back to?" And she mentioned three or four of them because stewards had been quite friendly. And I said, yeah, but this is football. You've got to choose one. You can't choose three or four. That's not the point. And she said, yeah, well, they were all the same. And the word she used was same song, different lyrics. And, you know, and for someone outside of football, there's a lot of truth in that. So what is it that makes us different? What do we stand for? And Scotland, I mean, it's an iconic country with so many really strong, you know, iconic examples of its identity. You know, everything from its produce, the you know, the landscape, the history. There is so much wrapped up in football in that country that you don't see if you just attend it, particularly in the lower leagues where you'd think the identity would be stronger. So that's the first one. The second one's this whole idea of dialogue and engagement, and that's, you know, asking people. So, you know, don't just make the decision yourself what your identity is and what you're going to do. Talk to the community. You know, what do they think? What do the schools think? What do the businesses think? What, you know, what's the heritage connection in your part of the world? And obviously then this idea of engaging with fans, it's not just have a fan panel once a month, you know. And again, it's important that you have structured dialogue, you know, supports direct style. But it's just having a representative group of fans that you can have conversations with regularly. You know, what is it like to be a fan of this club? What does this town mean? What was the club do? You know, what did the club do differently in the past? So that's the second one. The third one is the experience. We've talked about that already, but making sure that the experience actually has things in it that make different fan groups feel proud and connected. And sometimes that just things not going wrong, getting a drink in town, getting a nice pie, getting through the turnstile without a delay, you know, being able to hear the PA, having a toilet that, you know, is functional. But often it's little things like, you know, how often do we celebrate the oldest fan at the club? You know, we do a lot for kids, we do a lot for schools, but actually, you know, what about the old people? They have the strongest connection to our identity. And that's an open goal for clubs, you know, to do that. You know how Sporting Memories, that charity, you has found that Sporting Memories, and particularly football memories, can actually slow the effects of dementia in men because it starts to reconnect. You know, I don't understand the physiology of the brain, but I know the guy who runs that organization, and he has me in tears just talking about the impact that memories of, you know, of, and it's not always glorious memories either. It's the everyday smells, you know, the little old man opening his packet of peanuts, the smell of Capstan Full Strength, you know, even at Roker Park, you know, the smell of farts. <You know? laughs> You know, because men are piling in at the last minute, having been in the working men's club, consuming large amounts of Double Maxim and peanuts and chips. And if you're a small child, you're usually at an angle that's going to endanger your life if you stand there for too long, you know?
Yeah, it's so funny, funny you mentioned that, though. Just I remember taking my granddad to a Bucky Thistle game a couple of years ago. He's from Bucky originally. Hadn't been since he was 19, in his 80s now. And the first thing he pointed out to me was a wall. He goes, yeah. I used to jump that wall. and you're right, it's the small things.
Yeah. I can remember 1969, October. I went to see Sunderland for the first time with my dad and my uncle Ken in a Ford Capri. I didn't know that. I had that told to me. But it wasn't the football I can remember. I mean, we drew 0-0. It was against Chelsea. We were relegated that season. So that was kind of, that's kind of the backdrop. That's the template for a Sunderland fan. But it was the seagulls, and it was the smell of hot dogs and onions. And the strong cigarettes, the Navy cigarettes that the old fellas used to smell. And I don't think I've smelled that since, or smelled that, or seen that in combination since. And, you know, if I did, I think I'd be transported somewhere. I'd probably, you know, go Doolally. But it's what people, you know, remember. And the last one of the four is the people. As I said to you before, it's the fact that if you compare football and even the most progressive football clubs and leagues with progressive businesses, let's just take Pret for an example. Or, you know, I don't know, Zappos, the shoe retailer in the States, or, I don't know, even Microsoft down in Reading at their offices. The fundamental driver of a sustainable business is engaged employees, you know, people who look forward to coming to work on a Monday morning. And you think if you worked in football, you'd be overjoyed. But we somehow have created an industry where people aren't valued. There's no connection between the club's identity and purpose in the people that work at that club. Now, I'm generalizing here. We all know that there are stewards of some clubs that absolutely epitomize that. If people said, what does this club stand for? They'd think of Eric, the steward that looks after the, you know, the home fans in that corner. But there's no proactive work. You know, when clubs aren't even asking the question, what do we stand for? How do you then give your people purpose? So what we get, we have a rating when we do our assessments of stewards, and it starts with unresponsive because some of them look unconscious. You know, you think you're going to have to revive them or make sure the defibrillator's nearby. And then you get the passive ones, you know, that you might get some life out of. Then you get the responsive ones that will answer a question. And then happily, you occasionally get the really proactive, engaging, jokey ones that understand, you know, what it means. And they can be the difference between somebody becoming a lifelong fan if they're a kid with the parents and never going back again. So they're the four areas, kind of the identity.
Mark, is it just stewards that you look at, or maybe kiosk staff come into play? Is it every touch point with a human?
Everything, yeah. We always telephone ahead as well if we can, if the club has a telephone line. So we'll telephone with a question. We'll tweet the club. We will look at the kiosk staff. We'll look at the club shop staff. We'll look at the ticket office staff. About anybody, you know, and we know, as you know, we use a range of experienced, if you like, professional assessors, as well as real fans, depending on the nature of the program we're doing. And I'm not, you know, I'm not here to say that they're all bad. I mean, some clubs are fantastic at it. Everton have the record now for 8 years in a row. Visit Britain, a tourist organization, assesses the Premier League clubs' experiences to exacting tourism standards. And I think Everton have come out with the best stewards for 8 years in a row. You know, so some clubs, you know, albeit in the upper echelons, are doing it very well, investing in it and actually trying to give their people purpose. You know, what does the club stand for? So how should we behave? What are the opportunities that you have to demonstrate what this club means to its community? And I think it's the smaller clubs that have the right, if you like, if not the duty, to have those conversations because they mean more. The fact that they're still there is often a quirk of history because they haven't won a trophy in 50 years. You know, so let's be proud of our identity because, you know, we don't have the football success.
I can't argue with any of that. You've done, obviously, you touched on it a little bit there, work with likes of Cardiff, and I think you've done work with Doncaster as well, if I'm right.
Yeah.
Is there any sort of, and you've won awards, like those clubs have gone on to win awards, is there any sort of examples that you go, do you know what, that made a big difference at the time?
You know, the one thing, and it's common to all of the clubs where it's worked, is that they've just decided to do something, and that's come from the top of the organisation. That's the biggest problem with this. It's like, it sounds so simple, but you know, when people say, what would you say is the kind of the magic formula? What's the secret to success? It's focus. It's focus. And like, for example, you know, there's a phrase that's appeared, I mean, we've been doing this since 2001 off and on. And the word fan engagement didn't exist before 2001. It somehow came along. I didn't invent it. I think it was invented by the digital marketing industry. But, you know, there are. But you know what I mean? It's kind of, you know, when we talk about engagement, and, you know, we'll talk about how you define that. But I think the main thing is focus. Part of the problem that football has is that it's not set up in a way that a modern business would be set up. So in a modern business, you'd have a lot of time spent understanding, you know, who are our customers, in inverted commas? What are the different groups? What do they think? What matters to them? We don't do that in football. We kind of assume it. The big clubs do it because they're trying to develop global marketplaces and global fan bases. So they do a lot of that. But traditionally, we've never done that. So that's one of the first reasons that we don't have the focus, because one of the fundamental things that you'd be doing if you did have the focus isn't happening. There's another one with Ryan Morant, who is at Motherwell, who has held a couple of jobs where the job title has been either fan experience manager or fan engagement manager. I saw someone respond to one of his club's tweets recently saying, well, why do we need to appoint someone in that role? Surely everybody, the directors, the employees and the clubs, know what the clubs stand for and should be practicing fan engagement. But of course, that doesn't happen because there's no kind of fulcrum, there's no touchstone, there's no anchor for it. So, you know, yes, it's just a symbolic thing, giving somebody that title. But once you do that, the fans presuppose that actually something proactive is going on. So that's another reason why it doesn't happen. And of course, if the senior people in the club never spend time walking the fan experience, never actually try and drive from their house, park in the car park with fans, walk up to the game with fans, buy a pie with fans, stand on the terraces, talk to fans, then of course, again, that's not going to happen either. So the word is that it's focus. And so when you go to Cardiff, Julian was able to move up through the ranks to get a senior commercial role where he could actually start making decisions. And one of the fundamental things he did, and I think this is hopefully a good answer to your question, they talked to fans and they said, you know, what do we need to improve? And the fans said, beer, season tickets and standing. Now, the three of us would hear that and we would probably guess cheaper beer. We'd probably guess cheaper season tickets. And we'll probably guess we want to stand all the time.
In Scotland, we would just be asking for a beer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's well past my beer time already. So, when they sat down and talked, and this was the hardcore fan base at Cardiff, when they sat down and talked to them, and that was a scary thing to do to start with, because they'd never done it before, and the club had a bit of a history of external perceptions weren't big. When we talked about beer, they weren't saying cheaper beer. They were saying better beer, but they were mainly saying faster beer, because we're the hardcore. We want to be back in our seats for the start of the second half, but it takes us so long to get a beer. We're never there. So it was the fans themselves who came up with the idea of Cardiff selling tokens to the value of a pint in the hour and a half before kickoff from one of the alcohol kiosks. I know it's different in Scotland, but at half time they would pre-pour a lot of cask ale, so independent cask ale, so not the fizzy stuff, really good beer. No security needed for cash because you're exchanging a token for a pint. You just need someone to make sure that people queue up properly and it's done. So that was a magical moment for them. The second one, season tickets. They didn't want cheaper ones because they're in the Championship. They know they need to invest money in the squad to get to the Premier League. They just want to be able to pay for them more easily. So they wanted interest-free over 12 months. You know. So again, if they hadn't done this exercise, that have come away thinking, oh, well, we can't make them cheaper because we need them to be more expensive. And the standing one was, you know, clearly standing is an issue, but it's not enforced in many clubs. But in Cardiff, you had different groups around the stadium. So the solution there was that we'll create one area where we will apply a higher tolerance towards the type of boisterous behaviours associated with passionately following a football club. Obviously, it's still a grey area for many clubs, but just listening. So that's another thing. So I think what Cardiff did really well was not just assume they knew what the answers were, but actually listen to the groups. And they suddenly realized they had some big opportunities. And they did one little thing, which I love. When they opened their new stadium, they rigged the automated turnstile system so that if a kiddie came through and swiped their card and it was their birthday that weekend, three red lights would flash. The family would be taken to sit in the dugout during the pre-match warm-up. So it doesn't bother the groundsman, doesn't bother the manager, doesn't bother the players. Magic moment, remember it for the rest of their lives and always come back. And that, you know, that's a simple thing. For Donny Rovers, Donny are a lovely club, do some amazing things. At the moment, they are actually developing an away family area to encourage more families to attend. Now, but they're making it as good as the home one. So there's the away mascot will be invited. There'll be all sorts of activities. There'll be, you know, lots of magic moments. I imagine being Donny, the family will get in the dugout. You know, there'll be an away family in the dugout before the game. They're a club that you can now go online and pre-order your kids' food box before the game and have it brought to the seat by the mascot. And we're talking tier three. This is tier three. It's not hard to, you know, it's not hard to do. It's not costly, but it says something. It's very, very symbolic. Donny always do a lot on CL. The SLOs are very good at Donny. They're a good example of how you get an SLO to work really well. The SLO, there are a few of them. They have at least two of them. They have their own Twitter account. They're very proactive with away fans. They greet away fans. They're very visible on a match day, but they listen and they learn. And, you know, again, that's given them focus.
Would you say that's the most important role of the SLO to listen and learn and just how to make the most of that role at a club?
I think that the biggest challenge for the SLO is often that the person in the role needs kind of that political organization experience to be able to sit right in the center, because they're the people that should be feeding into meetings. Like, for example, what's our identity as a club? What do we stand for? Now, the SLO might not be able to give you the full answer, but he or she should be capable of getting into the community and finding out. You know, I think a lot of British clubs, possibly because the way the SLO emerged as coming from Eastern Europe originally, where you did have big police issues and traveling fans and, you know, 500, I don't know, Croatian fans going to the derby in the away end, you know, it can be a bit tasty. And I think underpinning everything that UEFA did with the SLO was a sense that first and foremost, this is about security, this is about policing, and this is about, you know, avoiding violence. And I think for that reason, kind of us in Western Europe, where we might think we're a bit more developed and where issues of hooliganism are not what they were, we kind of think, well, we don't have that. So kind of, you know, where do they fit? I still think that's in the mindset of a lot of people at the top of the game. But for me, the opportunity is to be that person on the ground that's listening, that's, you know, connecting different ideas across the club, that actually represents the fan within the club, that stops things falling between a gap between communications, marketing, ticketing and operations, you know, which is what happens. So I think they have a strong role to play to do that. We've been writing a guide with the EFL, an SLO guide, that will be coming out, I think, towards the end of next season. Still a lot more work needs to be done on it. But actually trying to provide some very, very clear recommendations and guidelines as to what different SLOs could be doing in different size clubs. You know, because obviously John Paul at Celtic is a fantastic example of how you do it for a club like Celtic. You know, he really understands the club. He's got a profile within that club. He's respected among the fan base. And he's the touchstone for a lot of good things that happen at that club. But my club's different. You know, my club's different. At Sunderland, it would be a different type of role. And at a smaller club, it would be a different type of role. But I just don't think that a lot of football at the senior levels has really bought into the potential.
I was going to touch as well on you brought up the away fan experience at Doncaster there. You've talked about that for years as following your website and company and Twitter account. And would you recommend that maybe when the resource is a bit tighter, that home fans remain the priority? Or would you say that there's still a little bit that can be done in terms of the away fan to improve their experience at a match?
That's an interesting question, because it kind of presupposes that clubs are already doing things for the home fans.
Exactly, yeah.
And in my experience, they're not. You know, and when they start doing things, and perhaps actually that's such a good point you made, because in the last 3 or 4 years we've been working with the Football Supporters Federation down here in kind of a tripartite arrangement with the EFL, and it's been fascinating. You know, I know the guys there very well, and we knew that if we were going to look at the away fan one, we couldn't be sending in professional assessors, because we just didn't know, you know, what away, you know, nobody had written down anywhere what represents the ideal away fan experience. And that's because there isn't one. It's different according to different people. You know, you get just as diverse group of people travel away as come to home games. And it's dangerous to kind of characterize away fans as, you know, 50 beers before the game, a shout, you know, refusing to sit in the right accommodation, and generally being a little bit naughty. You know, that's maybe one section, but not all of them. So I think in answering your question, you know, if clubs were visibly doing lots for home fans, then, you know, fair enough. That's great. But I think clubs forget, I don't know the arrangements up in Scotland, but I think down here in England, the host club will retain 95% of the ticket revenue, you know, that's sold to away fans. So obviously that's an area where, you know, sustainability could be improved if more of them came. But of course, the culture and the whole kind of psyche around it is, we hate you, we want to beat you, you know, whereas, you know, the ideal is, welcome to our ground, we're going to look after you, we're going to beat you, you know, glint in the eye. That's tighter the way it should be. And that's, you know, but somehow in football, it's got to the point that we can make a lot more money, you know, and that's not the only reason you do it, but we could be much more sustainable with many more away fans coming here. Now, I appreciate you have some challenges in Scotland with Rangers and Celtic and the number that travel. And obviously Rangers have sent through the leagues recently has challenged a lot of people in terms of how you manage large numbers of fans. But what we found in England in the last 4 years is that there are generally four areas that the wide group of away fans are looking for. They want to be able to find information, not just about the ground and the accommodation and what's there, but what can we do when we get there? Where are the safe areas? Is there anywhere we can go if it's an evening kickoff, you know, and it's a Sunday game? Could we go somewhere before or after? So information is really important, making that available. The SLO is obviously important in providing that for the travelling fans, but the host club's SLO as well can do a really good job, you know, on that. The second area is the arrival. So that's the sense of welcome, not just hiding and, you know, getting them off the bus, taking the bottles off them and pointing them into the corner, but they're kind of tangibly meant to feel welcome. So when you've got people like Cardiff in the past that would have they were the first club to have the sign, thank you Middlesbrough for travelling, you know, 500 miles to support your club. Then you get inside the concourse, all the staff are wearing this season's Middlesbrough away kit, you know, which then get given to the Borough fans after the kiosks close. You've got the TVs are showing Middlesbrough's glory years, and you might even have a former Middlesbrough player that Cardiff have invited to come and spend time in the away end with Middlesbrough fans. So what happens? The word gets out. Cardiff's away fan, I think, if I remember correctly, went up 15% year on year, three seasons in a row, just by doing that. You know, Brighton obviously have the technology to light the away end concourse according to the colours of the away club, but they also open up the home and away areas after the game for a communal area where people can have a drink. Never any trouble. You know, I remember Tom Gorringe, who's now at Bristol Rovers, telling me about a lady who was a wheelchair user, ended up in the middle of a conga being swung round by fans of the opposition side, saying it was one of the best days she'd ever had. You know, so I think that, and then the next one is refreshments, social and refreshments, absolutely critical. You know, not to rip them off, not to give them crap, but actually to provide something that's good. It doesn't have to be 50 choices, just maybe two, but make them good. And then finally, and most importantly, the way that they are dealt with inside the stadium by the stewards, the way they are able to accommodate themselves, whether there's any pre-agreed flexibility, whether they have to sit in their seats. So we now know over 3 or 4 years that they are the four areas that if the host club gets right, will actually generate more away fans in future seasons. And so if you've got 500 away fans coming, spending 20 quid each, then what's that? That's £10,000. So if 10% come, 10% more come, you've got another £1,000, and then exponentially you end up, you know, with money to spend on the fan experience. So, you know, I think the first, the starting point, going back to your original question, the starting point has got to be the home fans, and it's got to be the core fans as well. You know, for me, it goes back to identity. You know, you don't need an excuse to sit down with your core fans. The reason is, let's just talk about whether or not you feel we're respecting what you believe this club stands for. And it's funny we should come back to Sunderland with that, because this is even a discovery for me that, you know, psychologically, I was on my knees last season because, you know, things just could not have got any worse. They can, of course, because there's real life outside of football. There's people in poverty. There's food banks. You know, we've got Brexit. You know, but for Sunderland, it was just, you know, my club has become a laughing stock. You know, there's no sense of the identity of the club. The owner did the right thing by covering all the debt, which is very good. But you have a situation now where we're in League One for the first time in 31 years, only the second time in our history, and yet fans have never felt so positive about the club. And it's been the little things that have happened. There's a lot of honesty from the owner. So he tells it like it is. He does sound like David Brent, which makes it a bit difficult sometimes, especially when he starts getting serious. But one of the things he did first was to do a podcast like you guys. He went and did either the Roker Report podcast. And the first question he got, and he said at the time, I'm terrified, you know, I'm going to get a load of abuse. The first question was, when are you going to tidy up those awful faded seats in the Stadium of Light? And it was kind of, it's got the point now where we don't care about the football anymore. We care about our club and what it was and what it's become. And so over the summer, they've opened up the stadium to fans. They've put on barbecues. The staff, the owner, and some players have got involved in actually putting in 31,000 new seats. Actually, we just wanted them cleaned. We didn't want new ones, but he's paid for 31,000 new seats. The ground looks fantastic. It's red and white. It's not beige and pink anymore. You know, it looks absolutely wonderful. And, you know, we feel we're football fans, so we overreact and we get overexcited. And I'm sat here thinking we're going to be back in the Champions League. We're going to be in the Champions League in four seasons, never having played a European game in now 45 years, any type of European game. But, you know, we've got that silly sort of optimism now because we've got somebody who understands that a football club is about more than results on the pitch. And of all 92 English Premier League and Football League clubs over the last 10 years, all 92, we have the worst home record. Worse than Oldham, Bury, worse than Rochdale, all of these clubs is us. And yet we've been in the Premier League, I think we're in the Premier League for those 10 years. And that's an amazing, you know, that tells you just how bad we are off the pitch. And so that's why, you know, fundamentally it comes down to the home fans, reconnecting with the home fans. It's not easy. You know, we know that a significant percentage of fans can be abusive, but social media isn't a mirror of the wider world. You know, it's where people go to shout at each other. The wider world is actually something in football that if you start with identity can be a really good place to go.
So you've got a stronger Scottish contingent at Sunderland for this season. So
we have.
I was going to say that too.
I bumped into Neil Doncaster recently, and he was speaking so highly of Jack Ross. And of course, we all watched St Mirren's, you know, rise last season. And he just seems to have a presence. You know, I don't know whether he's going to be the next Jurgen Klopp, whether he's going to be the next Bill Shankly or Alex Ferguson even. But yeah, we've got a Scottish contingent. We've got, you know, many of them like Mr. McGeoch we can't pronounce. but you know, he looks an interesting character. He's kind of certainly divided the fans who've seen the pre-season friendlies. You know, that he's either a lost genius or why did we sign him? Now I'm looking forward to it. We went through a phase with Roy Keane where every player we had was Irish, and now every player we have is Scottish. So we're looking forward to it. We always used to be fair. The days of Jim Baxter and people like that, we always were the team that had, you know, more Scots playing for us.
Oh, well, anybody listening to this podcast down the line, a few months down the line, so December or whenever it is, they'll be listening to this going, either laughing or agreeing that it's gone very well. So good luck.
I'm gonna say now that it's going to go very well.
We sort of finished with our guest with the same sort of question, and that one really is, in Scotland, obviously, I get like a Cardiff and a Doncaster, even though if Doncaster are in the third tier, they have got more money than somebody that's in a League One or League Two in Scotland. If you were to give one, two, three bits of advice, your final sort of tips for clubs at that level and lower, what would it be?
First one would be to ask why. Why are these people still coming? What is it about our club that means they still come? And help get them to help you articulate what it is that you represent. You have to be able to answer the question, what's my club for? Now, a lot of clubs answer that community, and football has a fantastic record. I love the work that the SPFL have done with getting, you know, unfit men back into being fit through football. Yeah, that's just brilliant stuff, and that's inspirational. But it's kind of, we don't need to, I think we need to go a step further. So, you know, by understanding what each club represents, then why can't our community teams be going out into the community and saying, come down to a game? You know, not just we're out there doing our bit and trying to address issues of our time, whether it's, you know, social exclusion, whether it's, you know, racism, whatever, bullying, you know, drug addiction, nutrition, whatever these issues, that's fine. We do a great job, but let's go a bit further and actually start getting people to come to games. I mean, it's what we're doing in Estonia, effectively. We've got three clubs. Their average attendance is probably 100, 300 and 500. And that's average for the top tier there. And we're basically saying, right, you three, these three, they're called club development officers. They are ring fenced. They only have two roles. One is to go out to schools, community groups, bring them to the game. And the second role is to make sure when they get there, you welcome them. They have a fantastic experience. And the second game at Narva Trans, which is on the Russian border, their average attendance last season was 112. Now, it's school holidays now, so there's no schools to go out to. So this guy's gone out to training clubs and football camps. They had 396 at the next game, and he's confidently predicting 800 at the weekend. You know, and that's because there is focus. So the first one for me is why. Ask the question why. And then the second one is, in your club, find a way to give it focus. Stop it from being an extracurricular thing that you do when you have time and when the team's not doing well, and actually have some focus, whatever that is, whether it's the SLO, whether you appoint, you know, one of the people in the club has the title, you know, supporter engagement director, whatever it, or start, you know, getting feedback from fans, but just do something. So symbolically something has changed and people see that the club's now doing something different. And then I think the third thing would be get some feedback on what the experience is like. It's very hard to do it when you're in the club already because you're so used to seeing things. But, you know, if you're a small club, why not get a couple of, you know, go into a local school, have a little project, get the kids to come to the match, get them to write stories about it. What did they like best? What did they dislike? You know, get some lapsed fans, try and get three or four fans that used to come but don't come anymore. Get them to attend two or three different games and just tell the story about what that was like. And then I think if you've got the why in place, you know what you stand for. If you've got some focus, so you've got a symbol that you're actually looking at these things. And then thirdly, if you've got some feedback, you then have a catalyst to change the things. And I think you can do that at any level. Don't think you need a budget for that.
Mark, absolutely fascinating chat. I've generally got some ideas in my head for what I want to implement, and I'm sure there's lots of people thinking the same. And I think you've proved the fact that I think whenever people talk about fan experience, they all automatically go to, we're Americanizing the sport and that side of things, but it's far from that. Yeah. There's just so much that can be done in this area, and it's the simple things, as you said, that can be done. So, yeah, no, thanks very much, and thank you for your time.
No, no problem at all. It's been a real pleasure. I've been looking forward to it. Thank you.
Great. Cheers, Mark.
Thank you very much. Cheers. Hopefully you've listened to the first couple of podcasts. And you'll know that we finish up with a few examples of things we've seen from clubs or organisations across sport and across the world, really. Michael, did you have anything this week?
Yep, keeping it homegrown ties in nicely, I would say, with the conversation we've just had with Mark there as well. Kilmarnock had out on their Twitter showing their Open Day, Family Fun Day that they had at Rugby Park. I know they're not the only club in Scotland that has done this. Dunfermline a couple of weeks ago, 2-3 weeks ago, done something similar. And there's clubs all across the country that do this sort of thing. And I think it just echoes a lot of what Mark had talked about. The second thing I've seen, and we're at the start of the season, we've a lot of games now coming thick and fast. And I just think there's been a step up in graphics use across social, across a number of different clubs in Scotland. And long it may it continue.
My probably only example this week is quite relevant to Mark as well, obviously talking about the EFL clubs that he's worked with. Yeovil are a bit well known for some interesting transfer announcements. They used one of Instagram Stories' new feature. Last couple of weeks they've released that. So they asked fans to ask questions on their Instagram story to try and guess who the new signing was going to be. Don't think many of them got it. It was a bit of a loan signing from a Premier League club, but obviously an interesting use of some social media new products.
Yeah, definitely innovative. And we talk about whatever topics we might cover in these podcasts, and we're definitely going to look at social media, and a good chance we'll focus and hone in on one or two of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, look, there's things out there that keep coming, and the only way to find out is to, whether they work or not for your club, is to try them.
Definitely.
Every now and again. And on that note, we'll wrap it up there. Chris, thank you again.
Cheers.